All right, Acts chapter 1, verse 9. This is where we have left off and where we begin today. We've talked about the power the apostles were promised in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, and looked at that in different ways. Beginning with Acts 1, verse 9, the text says, "And when he had said these things, as they were looking, he was taken up, and a cloud received him out of their sight." When Jesus was raised from the dead, were any human beings, at least to our knowledge, allowed to witness it? No. I mean, you've got, you know, angelic presence there at the tomb, but it's sealed, and Jesus comes back from the dead. Nobody gets to witness it. But now, he's raised from the dead. He's ready to ascend into heaven. Are there some witnesses? Yes. And who are the witnesses? They're going to be the apostles, and we've kind of tracked that through the first chapter of Acts. We started back there with verse 2, the apostles, and you can take that throughout Acts 1 and even to Acts 2 and show that the apostles are under consideration. So we have the apostles, they're looking, they're watching Jesus, and then he's taken out of their sight. It's kind of interesting to me that when you think about the apostles, would John, the writer of John, the writer of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and the writer of Revelation, been present on this occasion, you think? I would think so. I mean, if the apostles are there, John's an apostle. Well, take a look at what he describes over in the 12th chapter of Revelation. Now, maybe he was thinking back to this time, maybe not, but I think it's very interesting that in Revelation chapter 12, verse 5, John kind of gives a summary of a gospel in Revelation chapter 12. And in that fifth verse, he says, "And she was delivered of a son, a man-child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. Her child was caught up unto God, unto his throne." Now, if this was written, and I'm talking about the book of Acts, if this was written around 30 A.D., John's written perhaps 90 A.D., that would look back about 60 years to the time in Acts chapter 1. So very interesting that as John gives this mini summary of the gospel, he does include this detail, not only as a factual detail, but perhaps it's something that he was also able to witness. Now, we're not told why the Lord allowed the apostles to witness his ascension back into heaven, but I do think that there are some hints in the text. If you look back to where we were, Acts chapter 1, verses 3 and 6, Jesus there had some things to say about the kingdom. He spoke with them for 40 days concerning the kingdom of God. What had the apostles struggled with when it came to the kingdom? What were they thinking of, at least for a great period of time, when it came to the kingdom? It was going to be located where?
On earth.
On earth. All right. Who was going to be the king?
Jesus.
Now, if you're with the king, and he shoots up somehow into heaven, you're probably, if you're thinking in earthly terms, scratching the head and thinking, what? How's this going to work? So hopefully they had already sort of, in their minds, come to an acknowledgement that this was not going to be an earthly kingdom, but if they did have any misconceptions about that, this certainly should have shattered those ideas. Why else do you think the Lord may have ascended to heaven in their presence? Okay, that's a great introduction. I'm just going to add a little bit to it, but you're right. Anybody ever taken a child to college?
Yes.
All right, what happens? You know, there is that disconnect, right? You know, okay, we've got you unloaded, you know where the dorm is, and we've got to go. And when mom and dad head out the door, or when they get in the car and start driving off, what does that separation say, especially to the child?
You're on your own.
Do you think Jesus was, in some respects, disconnecting from the apostles? Yes, we've been together, but now as I go up, I'm going to take care of some things up here, and it's going to be your job to take care of the items down here on the earth. So it may have been a way of sort of refocusing their attention and saying, now it's time for you guys to take over. So you wait for that power that was promised, Acts 1, verses 3 through 8, and then you're going to begin to fulfill a new role. Now, here is one of the places where, and we don't want to get bogged down on this, but we can spend a couple minutes on it because it is sometimes a point of contention for people. Jesus goes back up into heaven. Everybody can agree on that. How did he go back up into heaven? Not everybody agrees on that. You've got some information about him ascending. You have some information about a cloud. But when you start breaking this down a little bit, some people get some different ideas. There have been some folks who have suggested that there was something like a cloud chariot that whisked him away. Well, maybe that's possible. I'm not sure that that's really the direction that the text takes us. Maybe the more traditional idea is that Jesus is, you know, rising. I mean, I don't think that was just like the Star Trek version where it was just beam me up and he's gone. But it does seem to be that he's slowly rising. And then there is some kind of cloud which covers him. And exactly what happened after that, I mean, he does make it into heaven. But exactly whether that was some kind of instant zapping or something, we don't know. There are some other questions, too, that come up. The word cloud is singular. And maybe in our minds as we've thought about that, well, let me just pose a quick question here. Let's just take a survey of hands to make it a little more interesting. How many have assumed over the years that this cloud was regular cloud? Like you go out and it's a cloudy day and you see a cumulus cloud or whatever it might be. How many have assumed it was a regular cloud? Okay, how many have assumed it was a glorious cloud, like we read about in the Old Testament? All right, so that's interesting. It's not quite half and half. But if you came here thinking, well, it had to be this way as far as the cloud, realize that there are some people who don't have that same view. Which way is right? I don't know. So it could be that he's going up and, you know, we can see pretty much, you know, you're out there at the fair, for example, and the balloon or whatever somebody has released, after a while it's out of sight. So maybe it was one of the white clouds, so to speak, that we see. Maybe it was some kind of glorious cloud. There's no way to prove it one way or the other. But we do know, for example, back in the book of Exodus chapter 40, you have the cloud that came upon the tabernacle. Remember that? That was the glorious cloud. Some people would refer to it as the Shekinah. Could God have used that? Sure. And maybe that would have been especially meaningful to the apostles. What about when we think about the transfiguration? Was there a cloud there? Yes. And again, it wasn't the ordinary kind of cloud you see. So it's kind of fascinating to consider that. It's interesting to see that not everybody looks at the cloud in the same way. We do have a little more information if we turn back to the book of Luke. Luke chapter 24, verses 50 to 52. Aside from this, we're really in the dark as far as the cloud and how quickly Jesus ascended. But I do think these final three verses in Luke are helpful. Somebody want to read them? Luke chapter 24, starting with verse 50, going through the end of the chapter. All right, Gary. Okay, now if you take these three verses and you combine them with Acts chapter 1, verse 9, you can piece together a few more details. You have Jesus lifting up his hands. We don't have that information in Acts chapter 1. And you do have, as you look at Acts chapter 1, verse 9, Jesus is speaking with them. So again, that's a detail that we may not typically recall or associate with this event, but we do have that same kind of thing today. Maybe it's a cruise ship. I've never wished anybody well as they're headed off into the deep blue sea and a cruise ship. But from the pictures I've seen, it's bon voyage, have a good time, those kinds of things. And then pretty soon, the ship is pulled out far enough where, at least verbally, there's no more communication. So Jesus is speaking with them as he's ascending back into heaven. He's lifted up his hands. He's blessing them. That may be part of the speaking in Acts chapter 1, verse 9. And then the end of verse 51 says he was carried up into heaven. And then, too, these details in verse 52. What they do, they worshipped him. That's interesting. Did they sing songs? Did they pray? I'm not sure. Bible just doesn't give us a lot of specific information about that, but it does tell us that they worshipped him, and it says they went to Jerusalem. What was their emotion? They had great joy. Very interesting. So they were apparently quite pleased that they were able to witness this, and then they were continually in the temple blessing God. So that sort of wraps it up as far as the basic details for the Lord's ascension. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've said so far? Okay. A couple other things that we have here.
Right.
I'm sorry.
You might have mentioned it, and I just didn't hear it. But when he ascended up, my assumption was that they saw his actual whole body and not a spirit.
That's, I think, we're going to deal with that in a little bit.
Because if you're witnessing his ascension as man, I think you can see a body.
Yeah. I'm going to deal with that a little bit later. So if I don't, in this class, deal with that in a suitable way, let me know. But let's just hold that because I think sequentially we'll get to that in a bit.
John 9, Luke 9:51 says, the days drew near for him to be taken up. He set his face to go to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So he was preparing for that.
Yes. Yeah. Both himself as well as what we see with the apostles, as we talked about earlier. They needed to be ready to carry on the work, so yes.
Where was his mother?
Mary?
I
don't know. They don't show up. You've got the 120 that we read about a little bit later. But here it seems like you've got Jesus just appearing to the apostles when it's time for the ascension. So they could have been back in Jerusalem. I think that's a logical place. So the apostles have made it out here. They're on the road to, or in the area of Bethany, it seems like. We'll talk about that probably in next class.
No, I'm just saying if my son was going somewhere and had come back from the dead,
Well, but remember, Jesus has been making appearances for 40 days.
Right.
So Mary has probably seen him. So after a month, still important to her? Yes. But she's probably had enough exposure to him where it's not like, I've got to see him every day and spend every moment with him. So I don't know exactly how that worked out. Maybe moms would differ on that, so I'm not going to try to venture some guesses there. But I do think Jerusalem is at least a good possibility. Bonnie and then Marcia.
Well, Mary was a special woman.
Yes.
She's probably not like me. She probably wasn't.
So.
Like you said, all the time she had exposure to him.
Yeah.
She knew he was special.
Yes. And again, you just kind of, like with a special child, if you have a special needs child, your perspective is going to likely be changed because of that. And with the angelic warnings that she had received, the sword's going to pierce your soul and so forth, those kinds of things. So she had to be thinking outside the box a little bit. So a little difficult for us to go back and understand exactly what was going on with her, but she probably realized this is a pretty steep learning curve. I mean, there's no books, there's nobody really that I can talk to. You know, you got John the Baptist's parents, Elizabeth, she was able to offer apparently at least a little help there. But this is brand new territory that we're trying to navigate.
That's what I was going to say. She knew from the moment of conception.
Yeah, I mean,
who he was and what was going to happen to him if she knew the Old Testament at all. And so,
yeah.
Okay, he came back from the dead. Hi, Mom. You know I got stuff to do.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just, she knew.
Yeah. Well, you have, it's maybe in John 19 or 20. I think it's John chapter 20. The words don't cling to me. So again, it seems like Jesus did have to deal with some clinginess to a certain degree and wasn't rude to people, but at the same time said, look, heaven's program is still progressing and what you want to do is not consistent with that. So we need to make sure we've got the right amount of separation here.
She was still close enough that she was with them.
Yes. There's no doubt that they tried to include her. She wasn't excluded by any means. But still, sometimes you might want to do more than your place in life allows. And I think that probably was something that did go through her mind. But it's, you know, sometimes I just kind of have to step back a little here and not do all that I might want to do. Dolores?
Maybe I'm missing it, but in the scripture it doesn't tell us that these people are expecting him to go up right now.
No.
This was kind of a surprise.
Well, there again, you're reading between the lines a little bit, but Jesus had told them as you look back.
There was not a certain calendar.
Right.
That said, by the way, at 12:15, y'all might want to come and look because I'm going.
Yeah. You have Jesus leading them out in the area of Bethany.
If the mother knew that, Mary, I think,
yes,
would have been there.
Yeah.
But maybe in a protection way, it was good that she wasn't to see him leaving
in. And again, heaven knows best, and that very possibly could, I mean, when you think about funerals, when you have somebody that is looking at their loved one being interred, sometimes they just can't let go. People have tried to crawl into the casket and do some other things. Now, you know, we don't know anything about Mary's emotional state. I'm sure that heaven used a very stable lady. But still, during times of great grief, even the most stable people can sometimes do some unpredictable things, and sometimes it's just better to avoid certain circumstances. And as you said, even the apostles, I don't know that they were given a stopwatch and said, bang. When we get to this point, Jesus is going to ascend. And he'd led them to so many places. He's been with them for 40 days, so let's go out here. And you've got the information in Luke chapter 24 that we just read too. They've got great joy. They worship. So that almost, to me, hints.
Every day was special to them.
Yeah.
And it would have been special to Mary. But there would have been no concrete indication that, this was it. This is when he's going.
Yeah. He'd made that promise. I need to leave and the Holy Spirit's going to come. I'm going to ascend. The Spirit's going to descend, to put it in a little simpler English. But yes, so they just kind of had to go with the flow, if you will. Okay, let's go back here and pick up a couple of the details. There have been some people who have asked if we can identify the spot from which Jesus ascended. Well, here you get back into the people who like to sell relics and things. There are some people who say, yes, they know exactly where this spot is. You've got the Church of the Ascension. I've never been to that site. You can pull it up on the web and look at it. But they claim that there is a spot there which has something like a human footprint. And supposedly that's the rock where Jesus pushed off. So, you know, to us that means seem comical. I don't think that the Lord needed to push off. And there was no rocket booster on there or anything, but people who are more interested in that kind of stuff than the biblical text, I mean, they will probably pay to see that kind of thing. So there is a rock which has that depression which looks like a man's foot. But based on Luke chapter 24, verse 50, headed out in the area of Bethany, and that's about all we can say as far as a general place. There's an old commentator, Adam Clark. I don't think you really need to hear the first part of what he said, but I'm going to read it because it flows better. He made what I thought several years ago was a really good point. He said, Jesus is speaking face to face with them. And while they beheld, he was taken up. He began to ascend into heaven, and they continued to look after him until a cloud received him out of their sight, till he had ascended above the region of the clouds by the density of which all further distinct vision was presented or prevented. So that's his assessment of the cloud. Then he goes on to say, these circumstances are very remarkable and should carefully be noted. They render insupportable the theory that states, and here's an idea that was especially prominent in his day and time, that our Lord did not ascend to heaven, that his being taken up signifies his going into some mountain, the top of which was covered by clouds or thick vapors, and that the two men in white garments were two priests, or Levites, who simply informed the disciples of his revisiting them again at some future time. Now, to us, that might sound really wild, but as we've been talking about on Sunday nights, when it comes to interpreting the Bible, there are people who have some ways to interpret the Scriptures that if they were to explain them to us, we'd think, boy, you're from Pluto. You're just way out there. But this is not new. People have been doing this kind of thing for a long time, and they will take the details, the same details that we have, but they'll look at them sometimes in a very naturalistic way. We talked about that to some degree last Sunday night, and every thing that's miraculous in the Bible, they will try to bring it down to human terms and say, well, it did happen, but it wasn't a miracle. It was something that occurred on a human level. So, as I say, this has been done for a long time. Reinterpret the two men, which I think you can at least infer with a reasonable degree of confidence that they were angels, but say that they were priests, and Jesus really didn't go up into heaven. He was just up there in a high mountain and covered with clouds and those kinds of things. But, you know, people can say whatever they want or deny any truth that they want. That doesn't mean it's true. Anything that you want to discuss before we look at verses 10 and 11? Yes, there. If you take that view, then he likely would have died a natural death somewhere because you've denied the supernatural.
But yeah, he walked where no one ever recognized him.
You'd have to conclude that. Or he's staying up there in the mountains and only certain people get. So like I say, once you start down that road, you just have to adjust and change and modify to keep your little air going. And people do that. But yes, you're right. Anybody else before we look at Acts 1, 10 and 11? Okay, starting with verse 10, the text says, and while they were looking steadfastly into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, ye men of Galilee, why stand ye looking into heaven? This Jesus who was received up from you into heaven shall so come in like manner as ye beheld him going into heaven. All right, a couple points here as far as what we want to make on our notes. As Jesus returned to heaven, that is, the apostles, they were looking steadfastly into heaven, or that is, the sky. As we mentioned earlier, sometimes that might be similar to what we do. You see a balloon, or there's something that's in the sky. Maybe you watch a plane for a while. Maybe you have jet fighters or this helicopter that comes over, and you're able to watch it. Or if you've ever been out on a boat, you can see something on the horizon. Maybe you're on the shore, and when that gets past the horizon, it's out of sight. And you can see it, and then all of a sudden, the next moment, it's gone. And that seems to be what Luke is describing here. It's really interesting, and if you've wondered about what we have on the board, we're now about ready for that. Luke uses some very unique verbs here, and also some interesting tense. When we look at the word translated steadfastly, and I'd like to get some cross-references lined up here. This is that word in verse 10, I abbreviated it, but this word has the idea of single-mindedness. It is a word which describes seriousness. So sometimes we look at something, we glance at it, and maybe the glance is so fast we miss some words, or maybe we misread some words. We're sort of careless. But that's not what's described here, and that's why I think the word steadfastly does it very well. Let's see. It's a word which is associated with some supernatural events. Let's look about three or four of these passages. Acts 3, 4. Let's get somebody lined up for that in a minute. Acts 3, verse 4, Carol. Then we'll look at Acts 7, 55. Acts 7, verse 55, Glenda. Then Acts 10, verse 4. Don, Acts 10, 4. And then Acts 13, verse 9. Acts 13, 9. Who wants to take that one? All right, Jenny. Let's start with Acts chapter 3, verse 4. Acts 3, 4. Okay. So here you have a man who's been very ill for a while, and they're looking at him. They're concentrating on him. They're really focused on him, and they're telling him, look at us. Ever have a doctor do that to you? Go in there, and maybe for some reason the doctor is really focused. Sometimes maybe he's kind of listening to you, half listening and writing some stuff down, or maybe it's a lady doctor. But there's some other times where the doctor is listening to everything. I got an infectious disease. Well, maybe he's concerned about getting it, so, you know, he wants all the details. All right, Acts chapter 7, verse 55. All right, if God opened up heaven and let you take a look, you think, oh, okay, that's neat. What do you think you do? Eyes are riveted. This is my time to see what it's like up there, and that's what's being described there. He is very serious. It is a steadfast look. He wants to capture all he can. It's like the doctor. All right, then we have, after that, Acts chapter 10, verse 4. Okay, this is Cornelius, has the angelic account. If an angel shows up and begins to interact with you, how much attention do you think you're going to associate with the event? I'm completely focused. This is a very serious matter. You have my full, undivided attention. And then Acts chapter 13, verse 9.
Then Saul, who also is called Paul, filled with the Holy Ghost, set his eyes on him.
Okay, and then you have the other events that take place. The fellow is blinded. But again, Paul is focused on him, supernatural event. It's a very serious matter, absolute concentration. So when we see that word in Acts chapter 1, verse 10, while they were looking steadfastly into heaven, well, sure, that makes sense. Jesus is going up, and they want to, you know, capture that moment. I think most people would conclude that this is not going to be something we ever get to see again. Then we have another key word. This is going to be the term in verse 11. It is a word which is translated beheld, or some translations would say seen. I'm not sure that either one of those translations really brings out the full force of the word, because it is also a very intense word. Some definitions for it would be penetrating scrutiny, intensive, thorough, lingering, astonished, reflective, comprehending, observation. Let's take a look at this, because I think it's kind of interesting to see where this second term is used. Matthew 6, verse 1. Who wants to take care of that? You'll have some time to get there. Matthew 6, 1. Lois? Bonnie, let's head you over to Matthew 23, verse 5. Matthew 23, 5. Then Luke chapter 5, verse 27. Luke, all right, Glenda. Then let's take a look at John 1:32. John 1:32. Steve. And then Jenny, let's take you over to John chapter 4, verse 35. Let's start with Matthew chapter 6, verse 1.
Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven.
Okay, if you're dealing with a person who wants to be a show-off at services, you think there is anybody like that? They want to be the show-off?
Sure.
All right. How fully do you think they want to be seen? Oh, yeah. I mean, it is max exposure, right? I want you to see me. I want you to observe me. I want you to witness every penny. I want you to witness how fine my prayer is. I want you to witness how good my sermon is. I want you to see how perfectly I lead the songs, all those kinds of things. Well, that's the same word that we find here in Acts chapter 1, verse 11. They said, why are you looking into heaven? You're trying to behold. You're trying to see that. All right, then we have our second passage, and that's going to be Matthew chapter 23, verse 5.
But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments.
Okay, related to Matthew chapter 6, verse 1, you hear you have a specific group of people. They do this to be seen of men. They want even the small items on the clothing to be seen. Very, very careful observation. All right, then next we have Luke 5, verse 27. 527.
After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth, and he said, follow me.
Okay, I find that to be an interesting passage. Jesus knew what was in men, but when he goes out and he looks at Matthew, how does he look at him? Ah, come on, you look good to me. No. What kind of look does he give to this tax collector? Penetrating scrutiny. And maybe there's some lessons in there. Jesus thought, okay, You know, as a tax collector, I don't know if Matthew was honest or not, but I knew that many were notorious cheaters. And maybe Jesus is looking at him and thinking, okay, deep down, maybe you've cheated some people. Are you honest? Are you someone who's going to be a reputable apostle for me? But he does this penetrating scrutiny when it comes to this man and very likely the other apostles. All right, John chapter 1, verse... Okay. All right. If a thought comes back to you, bring it back. John chapter 1, verse 32.
And John bore witness, saying, I saw the Spirit descending from heaven like a dove, and he remained upon him.
Okay. If you were with John, you saw the Spirit descending from heaven in the form of a dove. Again, what kind of focus would you have on that activity? You're not interested in anything else. Not interested in the fisherman, not interested in what somebody's saying. I mean, hey, this is important. My full attention is there. And then finally, John chapter 4, verse 35.
35?
435,
Say not, yea, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for there are white already to harvest.
Okay, do you think God is interested in saving man? Yeah. Do you think he's serious about that? Mm-hmm. So when Jesus talks to the apostles about that, he says, behold. Not just look, not just glance over here, but he's talking about the souls of people, and he says, you look in what way? Penetrating look. Serious look. Think about this. So when you see what the apostles were doing, this was a very, very big deal for them. One source tried to kind of summarize what we have in Acts 1:9 through 11. He said, as the disciples were looking, and that's where you have that first word up there, as they were just kind of glancing around a little bit, Jesus disappeared in a cloud. And then they began to take this intense look, two angels standing beside them, and they asked why they kept on looking earnestly. So that, going back to the question that you asked, Dolores, because of that word that's used initially, it sounds like they start out thinking, well, this is not going to be anything that is particularly unusual. No more unusual than anything else. And then all of a sudden, when things start to unfold, it's, oh, hey, all eyes are now focused here. So once again, I think you can use that to justify the conclusion that you offered earlier as far as it got a lot more serious than they had intended. They didn't expect, as far as I can tell, to lose Jesus, quote-unquote, on this occasion. So very, very interesting to see how he describes this. But leaving the time, but pausing before we deal with the rest of the matters here. Anything that you want to address based on what we just said? Okay, let's switch to the two men. Luke did not specifically identify the two men in white apparel as angels, but I think you have to infer that's what he meant. We find angels being discussed or being referenced at other times. Remember after Jesus was raised from the dead? Who do we read about? Angels. Now, not every account says two angels. That's not a contradiction. Sometimes the focus is just on one, but we do have some accounts where we also read about two angels. For example, let's pick up a couple of references here. Mark chapter 16, verse 5, Luke chapter 24, verse 4, and John chapter 20, verse 12. Mark 16, verse 5, who wants to head that way? Gary? Then we'll take a look at Luke 24, 4. Luke 24, 4, Don, thank you. And then we'll finally look at John 20, verse 12. John 20, verse 12, Bonnie. Let's start with Mark 16, verse 5. This description fascinates me. How is this angel described? As a young man. Now, maybe it's possible to read too much into that, but at the same time, I think if men and women and, you know, those who didn't become adults in heaven are going to in some way be reflective of angels, we don't become angels, but we're going to be, the Bible says, as angels. The fact that this angel, well, let me pause. Let's just back up and give you some information before we ask the question. When you think of a young man, what comes to mind? Okay. All right. That would be one good point. What else?
Strong.
All right. That would be another good point. What else? General age, strength, vigor, maybe a desire to learn, maybe somewhat inexperienced. And I think those are encouraging points when we think about eternity. You know, sometimes I think people have the idea, I'm going to be up there in heaven all, you know, crunched over and, you know, in the rocking chair. Not going to be able to do very much. Well, if people are going to be as angels like angels, I think what you have here in Mark chapter 15 or 16 is an encouraging passage. So, angelic presence there. Let's see what we have in our second verse. Luke chapter 24:4. And here we know that there were two angels present after the resurrection. Okay, shining garments, some translations would say dazzling apparel. What exactly is that like? I don't know, but it sure sounds nice, and that's how they're pictured here. Two men, very, very attractive apparel. Then you have John chapter 20, verse 12.
And seeth two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain.
Okay, so now we not only have these angels pictured as young men, Mark, we've got them as we look at Luke in dazzling apparel. And now as we look at John chapter 20, they're described as wearing clothing which has what color?
White.
Well, I think the answer to that, as far as the question why was it white, is obvious. Why do you think it was white? All right, pure, righteous. They were good angels. They were not associated with the devil, any kind of thing. Once again, it's a detail that is probably best looked at when we think about other passages in the Bible. But how many angels, max, do we find with the resurrection of Christ?
Two.
Two. How many angels do we find when it comes time for Jesus to go back into heaven?
Two.
Two. Now, maybe that's just a coincidence. But, you know, two here would have maybe caught my attention, but two here and two here, that really puts up my antenna. I'm kind of thinking, okay, why two and why two? I may not know for sure, but if you wanted to venture a guess or two, what might come to mind? Well, okay, that could be part of the symbolism. We don't know for sure, but that's a good thought. Thoughtful suggestion. Why two angels both times?
Is it like the buddy system, the witness type thing?
I think that's another thing to consider. Throughout the Bible, you have over in Revelation chapter 11, verse 3, I believe, John talks about the two witnesses. Remember Matthew chapter 18? You're working out something. Take two or three witnesses. And you have other passages in the Bible which also talk about two witnesses. So maybe they were not needed in any sense that they were witnesses, but they were there to just remind the apostles, look, witness has been given. You are the witnesses. Heaven has given plenty of witnesses that Jesus is the Son of God. He's going back into heaven. So not quite sure why that detail is there, but it is fascinating. Angels were provided at both events, and the number of angels was the same on each occasion. Yes. Yeah. And sometimes, like I said earlier, you have a focus on just one, but when you look at the other accounts, we know that there were at least two there. But that's nice. If you're focusing on one, you can still pick up some additional details. Other accounts focus on both and give us some insight as far as each of them. So it's helpful to look at those additional passages. Anybody else? All right, let's think for a minute about angels and the life of Christ. We see them having an active part in the life of Jesus as well as the apostles. Angels, were they involved with Jesus' conception and his birth?
Yes.
Yes. Angels show up. We talked about with Mary what happened with her. And you have over there in Luke chapter 2, the shepherds in the field. Well, you've got this heavenly host, which from what I can tell consists of angels. So a lot of angelic activity there. What about with the Lord's resurrection? Yes, we've already seen that from some of the passages. Matthew 28, verses 5 through 7 would be another verse or two we could read, but we didn't do that. All right, when we think about Jesus, and we've talked about this at various times, who's going to accompany the Lord when he returns at the end of time? Angels. Anybody remember how many angels? No? Let's get it from the Bible, Matthew 25, verse 31. It's a small point. But as Jesus talks about the sheep and the goat, the saved and the lost at the end of time, he tucks in a little thought that is a small detail but important. And let's also have somebody move back to Matthew chapter 13, that same book, about 12 chapters back, and pick up verses 41 and 42, and we'll read those separately. Who wants to take care of, in just a minute, Matthew 13, 41 and 42? All right, that'll be Gary. But let's start with Matthew 25, verse 31. Who wants to read it? Lois?
But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne.
Okay, how many angels are going to be left behind in heaven when the Lord comes? Not a single one. Now that's interesting to me. The Bible talks about in the book of Hebrews an innumerable host of angels. There are bunches and bunches and bunches of them. And every single one is going to come with the Lord. You think you can miss Jesus' next and final coming? Absolutely not. It's going to be a very busy day. A lot of activity. Then, let's go back to Matthew 13. Start with verse 41, Gary. Say a couple points, and then we'll deal with verse 42.
The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend in them, and them which do iniquity.
Okay. Now, let's tie that in with what we just learned from Matthew 25, verse 31. How many angels are going to show up with the Lord at the end of time? All of them. Are they going to be involved in any kind of activity? Yes. What are they going to do? They're going to gather up the bad folks. John also talked about this in Revelation chapter 14. So if you are collected by an angel at the end of time, guess what? Bad news for you. Hell's in your future. So you don't want to be picked up by an angel. Revelation chapter 14 talks about the fact, and this is also quite fascinating, Jesus will be the one who collects his people. And Paul hinted at that with the Thessalonians. Remember, he said we're going to be caught up together to meet who? The Lord in the air. So Jesus is going to be the collector for the saved. Angels are going to be used to collect the unsaved. There's a hand over here, but let's get verse 42 as well.
And shall cast them into a furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Okay. Well, this kind of completes the thought. Jesus comes with all the angels. Angels are used to collect the unsaved, Matthew 13, verse 41. And then, after they've got them, what do they do with them? Angels are going to be the ones who cast the unsaved into hell. Very interesting. Now, why they do that, I don't know. Some have postulated that maybe that's going to show God's disdain for sin. I don't even want to touch them, so to speak. I'm going to have my servants. Maybe that's a way of showing God's power. He doesn't need to do it. His servants, angels, are powerful enough to do that. You're the backup. Glenda or somebody over there had a hand on my left.
How is kingdom used here? Is that pertaining to the church?
Okay, which verse?
Verse 41.
Okay, would you read it?
Gather out of his kingdom all that causes sin and all lawbreakers.
Yeah.
And throw them into the fire furnace.
I think
that would be worse weeping and gnashing of teeth, especially when you're a Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kingdom, I would understand it in the general definition of the word kingdom, and that is God's reign, God's rule. He's over all. So you have there a reference to the people who have lived throughout human history. During the church age, yes. During the Mosaic age, yes. Prior to the Mosaic age, yes. So just think of that as every person in a pot, basically. And inside that pot, all the unrighteous angels will be collecting them. Now, that brings up all kinds of interesting things. How will angels know who's righteous and who's not? I don't know. There's some interesting questions there. But I think we can have confidence in the fact that they're not going to make any mistakes. They're not going to grab a righteous one and say, well, okay, we're going to...
Oops.
Yeah, we're going to have an oops and drop you in hell. But like I say, it's very, very... It stretches the mind a little bit. Bonnie?
Well, could it be the angels escorting those folks there because God can't stand to be in the presence of evil?
It's a thought.
So he can't go there. So the angels are going to do it for him.
It's a thought. So
yeah, it's all a thought. I mean, we don't...
No, we know, right. Ultimately, we know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
All the reasons for it, we don't know. But, yeah.
The important thing is that we do what we can now so that we're not in that position.
In that position. Anybody else?
So we're saying his kingdom here, in the sense, means the whole world. That's what his kingdom is meaning in this verse.
Yeah, that would be how I would define it. Anybody else? Okay. Well, we've got about 4 minutes left, and let's make some other quick points here. The good angels know some things. They knew that the apostles were from where? They said, ye men of Galilee. We believe that every apostle except Judas was from the area of Galilee, and the angels were certainly able to communicate with the apostles. They were asking a question. That was how they began. They said, why are you standing here looking up into heaven? And then they said some other things. They said the Lord had been received up into heaven. They knew what the plans were for Jesus. They knew that there was nothing these men could benefit from as far as continuing to stay there. They'd seen everything that was needing to be done. Jesus had ascended back into heaven, and they were going to receive the power. The Holy Spirit was going to descend soon, so it was time for them to move on their way. Now, going back to what Sherman asked earlier, the angels also wanted the apostles to know that the Lord was going to do what? They said he's going to come back, he's going to return, and they said he is going to return how? In the same manner. All right, when he goes up, is he in a bodily form or spirit form? They're able to see him, so what's that tell us? He was in a bodily form. Was he visible or was he invisible? He was visible. So if he's going to return in the same way, what would you conclude about the form? It's also going to be bodily. What would you conclude about him being visible or invisible? It's going to be visible. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses believe, they claim that Jesus came back invisibly. I think that year was 19, verse 14, or he came back secretly, but he didn't depart in that kind of way. When you look at other passages, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17, the Bible says the Lord himself is going to descend, which would also support a bodily presence. You've also got that addressed in the 2 Thessalonian letter. Now, angels know that Jesus is going to return. They don't know when that will be. Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. Any other information on that, Sherman, that you wanted to... Okay. All right. One source that I like sometimes said this. When Jesus was here before men, people dared to arraign him, but he shall sit and judge them at the end of time. Once he was in their hands, then shall they be in his. Once they cried away with him, then shall he depart, or then shall he say, depart from me. I like those points because they show what the Lord allowed and what's going to occur at the end of time. Two, this is something which will not develop as far as looking at the references, but I do want to mention it quickly. When you look at the apostles and you look at the angels at both the resurrection of Christ and the ascension, you find that the angels largely behaved in the same way. For example, they're introduced in a similar way. Acts chapter 1, verse 10, if you took that passage and compared it to Luke chapter 24, verse 4, you'd find that the introduction is very similar. On both occasions, they began by asking the apostles a question. Resurrection, ask them a question. Ascension, time, ask them a question. And the question that they ask on both occasions begins with why. Why? You also find, as you look at these two events, that angels refer to Jesus' absence on both occasions. He's not here. Remember that statement coming from the lips of the angel? And you have a similar thing in Acts chapter 1, verse 11. Luke chapter 24, 6 and 7, the angels talked about what was lying ahead. And you see that also in Acts chapter 1, verse 11. Now, let's wrap it up here and then be prepared for our next class. We'll have a good breaking point with Acts 1:12 and following next time. Why do you think the apostles were able to interact with these angels? Why did heaven send angels? Well, let me toss out this possibility. I think it may have been for comfort. And here's why I say that. When you think about the apostles, they had come to Jerusalem with Jesus. They were thinking that he was going to be a king. Remember the Passover that we've talked about in recent classes? In our Wednesday night classes, they had celebrated the Passover with him, and then they had been exposed to his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion. 3 days later, they hear about him being raised from the dead. Then they've got another 40 days with him. Going back to what Dolores says earlier, now, apparently somewhat unexpectedly, he goes back into heaven and so forth. When you go through those events that quickly, just a little over a month, I mean, you've kind of gone from hero to zero. You've gone up and down and around the mountain a couple of times. You think your head might be spinning a little bit? You'd want some reassurance? Sure. Especially if Jesus is heading out. So the apostles may have had this angelic visit for that reason. Then, too, do you think in the midst of all this, the authorities still had some questions? I mean, Jesus was a big thorn in the side. People are running around talking, hey, maybe he's been raised from the dead. Who were the authorities probably going to be looking to get some answers? Like the FBI, when they're coming and trying to investigate a case, who are they going to go see? The people closest to the person being investigated or the person closest to the event.